part of reaching self-actualization is teaching you how to respond to violent situations, because the world is violent. So we have to deal with physical safety first. And then from there, we can get to emotional safety or spiritual safety. But without the aspect of actually making decisions and doing it so many times, people do not have physical safety, and that's being completely left out.
Welcome to the podcast, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in. My name is Danny Cola. In today's episode, I interview Mark Wildman. Mark is a steel mace, kettlebell, and steel club coach out of Los Angeles, California. I've been learning from Mark's YouTube channel the last 4 years, and I think he's one of the best steel club coaches out there that break down the fundamentals of unconventional tools. Learning from his YouTube channel, I've kind of taken in as much information as possible and used it to not only train myself, but teach my local tribe. This podcast was amazing. We talk a little bit about those fundamental steel club exercises, the benefits of using steel clubs, some goals that Mark has for himself when it comes to swinging heavier and heavier clubs that didn't exist up until the last few years. So Mark is now thinking about swinging 60, 70, and 80-pound clubs. I mean, you have to be astronomically strong to shield cast an 80-pound steel club. But anyways, he's a fascinating guy. He talks a little bit about his seminars that he's been doing all over the world, where he basically takes steel clubs, steel maces, and mixes that in with staff fighting, and the process of putting yourself in position to learn as much as you can in a short amount of time, do something different, go back to what you learned, and basically putting the nervous system and priming the nervous system to be the best learner possible so that you can be the best version of yourself possible. So without further ado, here's Mark on the podcast. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I enjoyed having it. All right, Mark Wildman, what's up, man? Long time.
How you doing, Danny?
Very good. Pleasure. How are you? Pleasure to see you as well.
Good. Just finished my morning workout, trying to get back to getting in some decent training every morning. I was traveling for so long that I was way off schedule, way off plan. Mm. But I've got my monster clubs here, so I'm finally getting back into this monster club training program, which is pretty cool.
I did see you and Dutchman unbox like 55, 65, 75. What was it? How many pound clubs that you got there that you guys were shield casting?
32K, 36K, 40K. So think of that as 70 pounds. 80 and 88, I think, are the numbers. I'm getting a 34 and a 36 cent here right now. I was working with Great Lakes Gear to make more monster clubs because the odds of people surviving 4K jumps are extraordinarily low. So we've got some 34s. Now we have the jumps in the middle, 32 up to, I think, 52K.
Wow.
So I'm chasing this really dumb thing that I've read about for my whole life. The Great Gamma could famously shield cast an 80-pound club for like 1,000 reps. And I don't know if we're going to get to that. But so the goal is to make 80 pounds my 80% weight at minimum, which means I need to get to at least 100-pound club for 10 sets of 10. So we have above that. 48K is 106 pounds. I think 52 is like 115.
10 sets of 10, so, 5 inside, 5 outside, or 10 inside, 10 outside?
Pure 10 shield cast, top hand past opposite ear.
Okay.
Is what I'm shooting for, because that's the strongest one you can do.
Okay.
And then you can do reverse shield cast, top hand pass, same side ear, and that can be your 80%. So I'm just chasing that because I've read about it my whole life and the equipment didn't really exist. So I started working with companies to try to get the equipment to exist, because if your max is 115 for 3 reps, suddenly 80 pounds becomes a number you could potentially learn to endure with.
You know, dude, I love how, I mean, although clubs and lever loaded training has been around for, you know, as we talk about, for all of human history, it's interesting now that, you know, some of the equipment never existed up until just now, right?
Well, the equipment existed in other countries. It doesn't exist for us. Mm. So you can still find monster clubs that are hundreds of years old in the mountains or in specific training facilities in other countries where they never stopped doing that type of training.
Yeah.
But they're not commonly lifted. There's always monster clubs the same way that there are monster lifting stones, like in Scotland, the mm-hmm. monster lifting stones that are all over the country, and they're all named. And, you know, some of them have only ever been lifted one time by one guy, and they carved his name into the side of it. So I think, you know, the useful range for people is 15 to 50 pounds. Anybody can get that if you're male, and think 10 to 30 pounds. Absolutely. Anybody can get that female structure. But I want to turn 50 pounds into a 50%, which okay. is a hard idea. So we're going back to treating it more like barbell and trying to create monster clubs, because I want an 80% 80 pound club. So the math is really easy. If you get to 106 pounds, 80 now becomes your 80% of your max. So you should be able to figure out how many you can do. So I'm trying to get to 10 sets of 10 with at minimum that 80 pound club. And I'm going to do it by trying to get to 10 sets of 10 with the 115. It's going to take a long time. That's a lot of adaptation, and the odds of you screwing it up are high. So it's like a multi-year strategy to attain this one idea.
Very interesting. I mean, people chase strength goals all the time. It's a fun little journey.
Yeah. Why wouldn't you do it? You're going to live to be like 70 or 80. I'm halfway through the game at this point. You might as well chase a couple of things that you could never chase before. For years, I just chased the 50, because you used to have available in North America, you know, 15, 20, 25, 35, and 45. Anything above 45 just simply did not exist. I worked with that company, ADEX, down in Florida, and they made the ADEX Wildman. And the goal of that was to get everybody in the world to a 50-pound club by having 1.25-pound jumps. Just like you can microload a barbell, now you can microload a club. Then success becomes very attainable. But now we're chasing double that just for fun. It'll be
cool. I just got the Wildman handle club and mace, and I gotta say, I fucking love it.
Yeah, it's all about how your hand contacts. I really like a 1.4 to 1.5 diameter handle on a 50 pound and under club. Above that, I think things change quite a bit, but everything about the whole thing changes above that.
Yeah,
but it's supposed to mimic weapons. I'm specifically mimicking battle maces and clubs that me and my friends own or have trained with. I work with some armored combat fighters. So if the handle is too small, they're wearing gauntlets, they're wearing armor, the handle has to be a specific size in order for their hand not to interfere with itself, because the way that gloves have seams on the tips of the fingers and stuff can interfere with your grip. It just takes your mind away from something you don't need to take your mind away from. So I'm all about designing grip size to be correct for the weight range that you're trying to use.
And then with the add-on kit that goes up to the 50 pounds, you said, when you could with the adjustable mace or club.
Yeah. Yeah. The whole goal was to get people something that can get from, what's the low end of that? 4.5 pounds.
4.5 is the handle, and then 6 with the thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I want everybody to be able to get to at least 50 pounds with that one piece of equipment. And the whole goal is that I wanted all of that to fit inside of a Pelican 1510 case.
Yeah.
So that that's a carry-on sized Pelican case. But that means that it's small enough that it doesn't have to go to oversized baggage, even at the weight that it's at, and it's really easy to get in and out of a car. Bigger cases, harder to get in. You can get that case inside of almost any car, so that you can travel with it really effectively.
Yeah,
I travel all the time. I've traveled for work, trained for work for years, and making kit useful, infinitely useful, and packable and shippable is a huge deal. Huge deal when it comes to training internationally.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the biggest things I picked up from you, just like learning about your content the last few years and like
having conversations with you is making things practical, easy to use, indestructible, most bang for your buck, short amount of workout time, yielding the biggest amount of results. I feel like that's been part of your philosophy that I've kind of taken into my own philosophy here, and making things as practical as possible. And I really, really like this concept when you're talking about long-term health and wellness and optimal movement.
Ironically, health and wellness is more of an elitism thing. So a lot of people treat health and fitness as some type of elite activity. And I think that barbelling, or like competition Olympic lifting, is kind of like an elite activity, because you need space for a 7-foot barbell.
Yeah.
You need a couple of 100 pounds of plates. You need an Olympic lifting platform. Otherwise, you're going to destroy the building that you're in. And it's not portable. It means that you have to have a way to stay close enough to that setup to get good at it over the course of 8 years. To me, that has never, ever, ever been something that I could practically do ever in my entire life. But a club is practical. You can do it anywhere. You don't have to travel. You don't have to have the travel time plus the gym time plus the cool down time plus the travel back time in order to do it. You can just pull it out. You know, I've trained in parking lots in the north of Scotland, where you pull it out as the sun is coming up and you've got 32 minutes before you need to be on set. And so you pull it out, you set it up, and you rock a program in the rain, you put it all back in the car, and you're ready to walk on set. But if you're working 12 to 14 hours a day, fitness is an elite thing. You don't have that extra time to do something like barbell. I love bodybuilding. We all love Arnold Schwarzenegger. We all grew up on his movies, but Arnold Schwarzenegger spent hours and hours every day. And I have never had the luxury of doing that. So I don't want to talk about that stuff. It's just not practical to me. I want people to train out front of the barn with a piece of metal that they can leave in the barn for 50 years and they'll come back. It'll be exactly the same. Nothing is changed.
Yeah, I fucking love that. I love that. And I've been using that type of philosophy with just kind of sharing with people, like, take the excuse away, every single excuse away out of your mind to get the workout done. Just get your workout done. When you have a club, kettlebells at home, you're just way more likely, I think, to pick them up and use them, especially once you've learned a couple of things. What do you think is, like, when you say, I want to do a specific exercise with a club, like, what is the go-to 1, 2, 3 exercises with the club that you need to get to? I mean, we have barbell, we got, you know, front squat, back squat, deadlift, overhead press, or whatever. Like, what are those 5 with the club that you think, like, if you're training to be a strong person, that you need to do with the club?
I think that the first 3 exercises everybody should do, no matter what their sport, no matter what their age, doesn't matter if they play a sport or not, everybody should do shield cast, inside circle, and outside circle. Those movements are not covered in any other type of training, but they are key fundamental human movements. Everybody stands up and rotates when they pick things up. Everybody stands up and rotates the other way. There are 4 rotations: dominant hand, inside, outside, non-dominant hand, inside, outside. And you should do it in a way that's free of a $5,000 cable machine. There are a lot of really cool gym exercises where you rotate, but they require a $5,000 cable machine. Why don't we just use a giant chunk of metal and do exactly what people have done for literally all of human history? Hercules would have been doing inside circle, outside circle, and shield cast. Your mom should be doing inside circle, outside circle, and shield cast. No question. Those are the top 3. After that, I would put in 3 more. I would put in alternating 180 pullover. It's a pullover where you rotate 180 degrees, 90 degrees off of one side, come through center, 90 degrees off the other side, and inside pendulum, outside pendulum. It's a clean. No matter what you do, you practice a clean. Barbell, kettlebell, dumbbell, pick up a weight, get it to shoulder height. Sandbag, if you're a roofer and you pick up a bale of shingles, you're doing a clean. If you're a farmer and you pick up a bale of hay, you're doing a clean. Clubs allow you to do a clean rotated. I don't really know of any rotated cleans in barbell. There is in landmine, which is an adaptation of barbell, but in clubs, you can do inside and outside cleans, because once again, there is 4. dominant hand inside, dominant hand outside, non-dominant hand inside, non-dominant hand outside. So I would say that those are the ones. Shield cast, inside circle, outside circle, inside pendulum, outside pendulum, 180 pullover.
Fantastic. That was in Mark Wildman fashion. Perfect. I love all the club work that you talk about and teach. I did also get the Wildman Fat Handle Mace that goes up to 33 pounds, I want to say.
Yeah, if you throw the add-on kit on it, though, it turns into a real monster, just so you know, ahead of time.
Have you messed with the add-on kit and gotten up to the, what does it get up to, like 45, 48 pounds or something like that?
No, I mean, it should go up well over 50 because the handle itself is pushing 10, right?
10 yeah,
plus
well,
spindle.
Yeah, 10, so 10
you,
and
you
a half.
Should be able to, you should be able to get above 50 with the add-on kit then.
Yeah, that might be right.
Because, so that's nasty. I like that handle. I like it as a wake-up mace. So I just have one set up. I think it's set up at about 35 right now. And I go out in the morning, and a couple of days a week, I use it as part of my wake up. Pure breathing, wake up, go outside for 4 minutes. Left hand high, 1 minute, left hand high, 4 minutes. Should be pushing 32 reps or so per minute. When it gets heavier, when it approaches 50 pounds, you're probably going to get down into like the 28 reps per minute range, but then you're still getting 100, even at the slow end, 100 activations of every muscle in your body, 100 inhales and exhales through the nose. I used to do it inhale and exhale through the mouth, the way you do it in a lot of styles of fighting, but I have a sinus issue from getting hit in the head with an axe a couple of years ago. And so somebody suggested I go back to nasal breathing for warm-up exercises. So that's what I'm using the Wildman handle for, is that morning, 100 rep minimum, nonstop breathing exercise, core activation exercise, rotation exercise, light up the brain, mm-hmm. and prepare yourself for the day. Everybody's got 4 minutes. You can wake up and you can walk outside and you can do 4 minutes nonstop. Because of the adjustability of it, you can start with just the handle and every month add 1.25 pounds to it for the next 5 years. Something positive will happen.
1,000%.
It's inevitable. There's no way out.
Yeah. Awesome piece of equipment. Don was great getting it over here. And my clients are loving it. A few of them bought one for their house as well, which is a no-brainer. So yeah, I'm very glad that equipment is out for people to have and start to learn and build strength systematically. Now, how do you go about like creating a program, let's say with the AdX Club specifically? How are you structuring it? How do you add weight? What's the protocol week by week? I want to get into the nitty gritty here on how you would structure something for somebody, let's say just an average person that wants to get up to the heaviest club or heaviest mace. How would you structure that?
I have two answers to this question. I have a short program, which is 20 minutes long, which is 5 exercises repeated in 4 rounds with multiple levels of complexity. That is out through Order in Progress right now. You know Will Safford of Order mm-hmm. in Progress.
Yep.
We have taken my big club program, the Basis of Strength, which is 7 levels times 8 types of complexity, 56 variations. And he said, that's great. Can we make it smaller? We can always make something better and smaller. So we reduced it down and we made a program that is 3 levels, 5 exercises, 15 total levels of complexity so that you can go up in weight faster. So we designed that one specifically for jiu-jitsu athletes, but it would work for absolutely anybody. So absolutely easiest program in the world, 5 exercises, 4 rounds, twice a week. Do maybe 5 to 6 workouts per level, per weight, go up 2.5 pounds, do the whole thing again, and work on chasing and going up in weight. Usually guys start around 15, 17.5, 20, 22.5, and your goal is to get up to 50. So you can see you can put some time into it. If you're bigger and stronger, you could reduce the number of workouts per weight down from 5 or 6. 5, 6 is really good if you only have 5-pound jumps. with 2.5 pound jumps, a lot of people will only have to do, say, 3 or 4 workouts per level per weight. And then all of these recommendations hold through for the big club program, the basis of strength, which is 8 exercises, 4 rounds, 32 minutes twice a week. So there's more families of movement and way more complexity. So it depends on what people's goals are. I used to use the 3 level times 5 movements program if an actor had to start putting on size quickly, because there's no way out. Every exercise is total body. Every exercise is rotation. Every exercise makes you better at doing martial movement, the fundamental things, so that they could do action much better. And if you had more time to prep, then you would do the long program, 7 levels. Or that one oftentimes we used for models and dancers because they don't want to go up in weight. So we alter the complexity of the system. So we stay at lightweights and we change complexity much more often. So fewer levels, fewer exercises, go up in weight. More levels, more complexity, stay at a lower weight for a much, much longer period of time. People who can't get bigger, female models, dancers, actresses, they need complexity, but they want to keep learning and becoming better at useful movement. So those are the 2 strategies that I use. Love fundamentally. That's for a 2-hand club program. And then that can house directly next to a single arm club program. So we call this an A-B cycle. A would be the 2-handed club program and it runs on its own math. And then 2 days a week would be a B program and it would be single arm club, where we would focus on 4 types of movements. And that goes up in its own math. But think getting through 3 weights with a single arm club program should take 24 weeks times 3. So it should take 1.5 years. But most people should do 7 weights and it should take 3.5 years at twice a week. The whole goal is that these things can stand alone and be useful anywhere in the world at any time. Pull it out of the back of a car, train in a parking lot, jump in the ocean, go swimming, ride a horse across the mountain, whatever. Or they can sit on top of gym training programs. So it could be, if you really wanted to be like Hercules really fast, it would be 2-handed club twice a week, low complexity, ramp the weight up, and then you would house it next to some days where you did pure pressing for, say, 1 hour, and then pure pulling for, say, 1 hour.
Got it. Love it. Very good. I would love to spend some time with you and learn a little bit about that stuff off mic, because I know like talking numbers and time and all that stuff can get a little, finicky on a podcast. But I'd have to come in and I want to learn more of that stuff, because seems like you've just been doing it for so long and you've got people that have seen wild results from it. Now I want to ask, how do the actors respond to seeing a club or using a club for the first time or kettlebell on sets like this? Like, do they learn quickly, or are you surprised by what they're capable of doing in a small amount of time? Like, how's that?
First things first, you got to convince people, anybody, that what you're doing is valuable. And that's not really super hard with clubs. You can point directly to movements and fight scenes and go, there's that exact movement. And so when you're coaching through, you simply say, movement, this is what it is. And they go, they start with a 15-pound club and they're always like, oh, this is going to be so easy. And then it annihilates them.
Yeah.
And then they very quickly go, oh my God, why have we not been doing this? It's not a long jump, because everybody's looking to get the most work done in the least amount of time. If you work in the entertainment industry of any type, your days are really long. An 8-hour day literally does not exist. In LA, you're looking at a 13-hour camera day because there's a walk-away lunch. If you're shooting in Europe, which is why a lot of people shoot in Europe now, you get French hours, which means a 10-hour camera day, and you work through lunch. But that's not a 10-hour day. You still have to be there 1 hour ahead of time for makeup, 11 hours. You have to transport 1 hour on each side. Now you're 13 hours. So now your workout needs to get into that 1 hour frame or 1.5 hour frame if your actor's really committed. So now you're at 14.5 hours for your day to get from portal to portal, which is an extraordinarily long period of time. So if you can show people something more valuable and it takes exactly 20 minutes. Now you can get in an 8 minute warm up of relevant, useful movement, a 2 minute transition, a 20 minute workout. Then you can stack on some kickers on the end, 10 minutes of exercises specifically designed to make you pretty. And then you can shove in 10 minutes to 20 minutes of cool down until somebody comes and takes them from you to the makeup trailer so that they can get ready for the rest of the day. So it's not hard once people do it one or two times.
Got
because
it.
They instantly see that it's perfect for what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
It's really perfect for anything, but film almost always has violence in it because violence creates drama. So the better you get at learning to rotate every direction, the faster you learn how to do fight scenes. Fight scenes are hilarious because a lot of people come in, and if they're a martial artist, they have a strong lead side. But you can't have a strong lead side if you're training for this type of thing because you don't know where the camera has to be. So if you're only good at one side and you can't instantly flip everything to the other side, you are a problem and you are costing everybody money because people have to sit around and wait for you to learn something. And that means 200 people could be standing around waiting for you to figure something out, which is not positive.
Right.
Definitely negative.
Yeah.
Because you're paying a lot of people, a lot of money, union wages to stand around. So getting better at doing clubs makes you better at everything very, very quickly. And people see the value in that pretty fast.
Yeah. Would you always have clubs, maces, and kettlebells, or would you throw in Bulgarian bag? Like, what would be like your go-to all the time? Like, what would...
It's always club and kettlebell. Club and kettlebell will fit in any vehicle. Mace, if you have a vehicle where you can shove a big long bar into it. But if you're transiting through urban areas, whatever car the actor has, a kettlebell and a club will always fit inside of it. So you can take them wherever they go. Maces come after that. Bulgarian bag, I don't bother dragging around at all. Why? I don't know why. Because Bulgarian bags weigh a lot, and so now you're back to occupying a shit ton of space. Yeah. And everything else. Yep. We now use adjustable kettlebells. We have a Wildman adjustable kettlebell from Bells of Steel, so you get 41 weights in one weight. So if you have two kettlebells, you now have access to 82 weights, which you wouldn't even be able to put in a box truck and drag around with you. So we're always getting more and more and more efficient. That is primary. So kettlebells and clubs, you have a ton of stuff. And then if you're occasionally going past a hotel with a good gym in it, or you have a gym trailer on set or something, then you can throw in some other stuff. But your core stuff is always kettlebells and clubs because they're the perfect complement to each other.
Hell yeah. Love that. So the last time we spoke, you were getting the Art Asylum all put together. How long has it been, you know, the Art Asylum? I know I've seen videos of you guys, you know, painting up and setting up new things. How's that process logistically going? And talk to me about some of the challenges and some of the cool things that have kind of gone on since you've been there.
Well, we've been in here about a year now. We have a ton of stuff done. The goal is to turn it into a space where we can both teach and nobody can tell us what to do.
Hell yeah.
Oftentimes when you go to other people's facilities, they want to tell you what you are and are not allowed to teach. So something like my staff seminar, it's not something people really want to be taught. Even if they see it and you tell them what it is, once you start teaching, they tend to tell you you're not allowed to teach it anymore, but you've had people fly in from all over the world to learn it. So you're definitely going to teach it. So we're trying to remove ourselves from other people's opinions, especially people who don't know what they're talking about. We'd like to get away from that. So we have a big interior space. We have an outdoor metal shop. We're doing some car fabrication for fun. Just built one of the coolest cars I've ever seen. It's an inline eight on top of a Suburban frame. So think like a 1930s gang mobster car on top of an off-road chassis with 40-inch tires. Super cool. Now inside here, we have this giant six-post Hydra squat rack. So instead of a normal four-poster, we have six, but that allows us to have a lot more pull-up bar heights and everything, and it becomes much, much, much more stable, even if it's not bolted to the ground, because we want to be able to move things around. We just got a new cable machine in from Bells of Steel, which is fun because it allows us to do kickers. When you do something like a club program, you have your 20 minutes or your 32-minute program. At the end of that, you can throw in a kicker, which is different every time. The kettlebell or a club program stresses the body predictably. It is your predictable movement strength training that goes up for years. But now with a cable machine, we can go back to throwing in kickers, which are designed just to make you pretty. We've got a giant GHD in here, which is the coolest thing, so that we can go back to training for aerial abs and aerial core. What else we got? Concept 2 ski erg, rower, Versa climber, wooden dummies. We have some giant hanging Muay Thai bags showing up, and we need to get at least one or two more wooden dummies because we want them to be able to move around.
Okay.
So you can do wooden dummy, like if you've ever seen Ip Man or Bruce Lee, then working on that. But I want to have at least three of them so you can move the distance between them every day so that you do the turning and approaching the next target, which is the footwork that's not in single dummy. So we want to be able to translate that through everything, because teaching people to turn left and right and then enter a technique is everything that you should be doing. Bad guys are always behind you. So we want to do that. Yeah, we've got some circus rigs up, and this thing in the background back here, if you can see that, Danny, that is that is an air system for ripping people off the ground for superhero takeoffs and superhero landings. So stunt guys can come in here and run through practicing things by changing pick points along the line of the roof. You can change how people are pulled and how far they go, and you can start with a low power and crank it up to a high power, move them a little bit, move them 40 feet. That thing will flip.
That's pretty
cars,
badass.
So.
Wow. Okay. That'll kill somebody if not used properly.
Yeah. You don't use it if you don't know what to do. You'll rip yourself in half. One of our guys is 20 years veteran of the film industry. So he knows how to do everything perfectly well and how to test it appropriately. You should test it every time with a sandbag that is the same weight as your actual person. Make it pretty close. If you're 241 pounds, make the bag 240 pounds. Don't make it 100 pounds. You have no clue what's going to happen. So you can always test it ahead of time and be like, move this far with no input from an actor or a mover.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's going well. It's fun. Good. We have some seminars coming up here in July, which is going to be staff and heavy club. I like to teach these two things together. Staff movement and heavy club movement. People instantly see what the basis of human athleticism is. It's use a lever to not get hit in the face and then to hit something as hard as possible.
Yeah, just a little bit I did with you in Italy. I was just blown away right away. I was like, it totally makes sense now. You know, because you get into maces first and then you got people using it for exercise and like strength training, you got people doing like flow stuff with it. And like, that was the first like understanding I got. I was like, okay, cool. Let's strength train with this stick. This looks pretty cool. Let's change it up. Right. And then you just kind of get into specific strength, tack fit, kind of timer, whatever, Tabatas or what have you. Then you got the flowy, dancey, self-expression, creativity type of stuff, which is all right. But then you see how it kind of coincides with actual stick fighting or sword fighting. And that's where kind of you come in and educate people on how this has been the way we've been moving our whole lives and defending ourselves and how it's kind of like ingrained in our DNA still. And when you kind of do the first couple of movements of it, you're like, oh yeah, you get it. And it definitely makes sense.
Mace and club make perfect sense forever after that. I never have to tell you why something is useful ever again, because you will instantly know. You should come to our next, we have a big staff one in the fall that's just pure staff, which is, so you get to go through twice as much information in the same amount of time, but you should come to these. They're super fun.
1,000%.
Guys come to like 10 of these in a row because they love it and they get better every time. And they just want to keep going because something like staff defense clearly demonstrates to somebody what flow state really is and what it's supposed to be. So there's a lot of people teaching flow, but they're leaving out this part of what the human brain's actually for. It is to designed to operate all the joints in your body to either get in, to get out of the way, or to get in the way, or to create force, or to move over obstacles. And so people talk about this a lot of ways. Mace flow is one of those things where they talk about the flow, but the flow is really still not the flow of what the human brain does. It is a supercomputer designed to keep you alive. So you should actually do that. So you then your flow stops being just self-expression and starts becoming useful movement patterns, which you drag in from your experience.
Yeah. No, interesting. So like, let's go deeper on flow state, because I think about, when I think about flow state, I don't just think about doing steel mace flow or club flow or whatever. I think about like being so engaged that no matter what is going on, like I'm just moving like I'm supposed to move within that moment. If it's like a game or whatever, or a fight, you know, you just do what you're supposed to do in that moment because you're so trained and prepared or what have you. Like your body just kind of naturally takes over because you know what to do. Like, how else can you incorporate and talk about flow state?
That's what I think flow state is. So I think that people should be doing flow state from that back and then expanding it out into other aspects of your life, which is the way that it used to be taught in the ancient world. Example, Kung Fu. The whole goal of Kung Fu was a physical practice, learn of swinging weights and using weapons and then combining them in useful movement patterns so that people could attain flow. This is best represented, I think, by Jackie Chan. In all of his movies, he's demonstrating what pure idiosyncratic human movement should look like. The goal of something like Kung Fu has always been to have this martial practice, which is a physical practice, which is a mental practice, which then expands into every aspect of your life in order to try to create an optimized human being. So I think that you start with the self-defense part, and it has to be not patterns. It has to be decisions. This is very different. Oftentimes now they are taught as patterns. Mace flow is people recreating martial arts forms, but leaving out the actual context of not getting hit in the face. And then we would like to take that ability. You've made so many decisions, your body learns how to optimize movement. And then the whole theory is that it bleeds out to everything else so that you can have flow in other aspects of your life. Think about this on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Mm-hmm. Maslow's at the base of the program, at the base of the pyramid, you have, you know, food, water, shelter,
and physical safety, basically.
Physical safety. And the reason that people in the modern world have extraordinary levels of anxiety is because they have no concept of what safety is. And they don't know that they don't know that they're not safe, which is anxiety. So part of reaching self-actualization is teaching you how to respond to violent situations, because the world is violent. So we have to deal with physical safety first. And then from there, we can get to emotional safety or spiritual safety, but without the aspect of actually making decisions and doing it so many times, people do not have physical safety, and that's being completely left out. So I always think of that. If you take anybody and you teach them staff the way that we do it, OODA loop, observe, orient, decide, act, and you run the drills in the correct way.
OODA loop, is that the acronym?
Yeah, the acronym is OODA loop. It stands for observe, orient, decide, act. When you're training forms, you've taken away all of them. So something like Mace Flow or Shaolin forms have removed the actual, you're supposed to imagine something, but you're trying to perfect a series of movements, which is different than actually learning to not get hit in the face. So what we really need is somebody to swing at you in such a way, and they don't tell you what it is ahead of time. So you actually have to observe something happening, figure out how to line up your body underneath it, the more times you do it, the better data your body has to figure out how to orient. Then you have to decide to not get hit in the face. Then you have to act to not get hit in the face. It's a decision, and you need to make that decision at least 10,000 times to have an understanding of it. But you probably 60 to 80,000 is a number that I like to hear get tossed around. And you should be able to get to that within about 50 hours of structured real staff training. But it has to be all decision, no form. And then that alters the way people's brain works forever.
Crazy. And this is the stuff you teach in your seminar, basically.
Yeah. The whole seminar is just setting people up and letting them run an experiment and then adding or changing one variable and let them run it again, change one variable, run it again. We treat it as super science. We don't treat it as a martial art. We treat it as a training neurological concept, which nobody else is doing, ironically, as far as I can tell. I'm sure somebody's doing it. That's the way it was taught hundreds of years ago. That's just not the way things are done now.
Yeah, everything is so physical and lift 100,000 pounds or whatever the physical goals are. And
nobody's queuing. Making the decisions. They're not deciding. There's a big thing in coaching about cueing. People think that if you just cue people the right way, then people will magically be able to do things, which drives me insane. You can cue the right way, but people still need to experimentally determine what the cues mean so that they can enact them. Because timing, distance, speed, and timing is everything. So without data, practice, people can't do things, even if the cueing is perfect.
Yeah. And like a good coach basically expresses themselves using the least amount of words possible.
Yes, right? That is good coaching should always use the least amount of words possible. I go back and forth between when people are under stress, less words. And then during break time, we do Q&A where we ask people questions and we go to the Socratic method where we propose a question and then we ask people to give us their understanding of their response. Then you go back to physical, smallest number of words. All chain, talk about only one thing at a time because that's what people can focus on under stress. And then go back to Socratic during break periods, back and forth, trying to hit all versions of learning, physical versions of learning, experiential, observing, and then talking about it, and then figuring out how to enact it. And then everybody who comes to a staff seminar, after about three staff seminars, you start having to teach sections of the staff seminar so that people are put under stress in order to express what they have learned, and then they get to work their way through it, but not so long that they start to freak out and the quality of instruction goes down.
Yeah. The only way to learn something optimally is if you teach it. You know, you force yourself to be put in that situation because you have to know as much as possible about it to articulate it to the next person who doesn't know or knows less than you. But yeah, it forces you to stay sharp on whatever it is that, you know, the lesson is organized around.
Yeah, so, I put that into every one of my seminars now, heavy club seminars, kettlebell seminars. It doesn't matter if you want to be a coach or not, if you are a professional coach. When you come to these seminars, everybody ends up in front of the class at least seven times. And that way we can change people not only physically by giving them coaching, having them experience it by doing it, but then they also have to start to explain it back. It doesn't matter if you're a professional coach or not. That should be inside of your seminars.
Agreed.
Because nobody gets into training unless they want to be a different person. They're trying to fundamentally alter some characteristic about themselves. And tons of seminars do not do that at all. Even if you're going for a high-level coaching seminar, they do not actually expect you to be up in front of the room, which is always shocking to me. So you should put it in. Just doesn't matter what level you are. You should be in front of the room as well for one technique at a time and cycle through so that everybody has to teach something.
It's scary.
Right? Yeah, it's terrifying. But if you do it right away and you don't leave it to higher levels of coaching, then by the time people get to higher levels of coaching, it's not scary anymore. The whole goal is to get rid of all of those things that inhibit your flow state. And being in front of a room and talking scares the shit out of people. So it should be in every seminar because you train physically to train mentally, to train spiritually, eventually. So do it, get in front of people, do it again, burn away that social stuff inside of your brain that keeps you scared and keeps you from doing things in life. Doesn't matter, has to be there.
Do you think that practicing stuff like this can help somebody suffering from anxiety or depression?
Oh yeah, there's no question about it. Absolutely no question about it. The combination of club swinging and mace swinging just on its own drastically lowers people's anxiety, because a lot of people have anxiety because they know, they're subconsciously, they know, whether they're conscious or not, that they don't know how to move. So when you, the second you start teaching people clubs, they tend to start getting lower levels of anxiety almost immediately, because their body goes back to doing what it's supposed to do. It starts to feel more physically safe. And then eventually you combine that with some type of observe, orient, decide, act, OODA loop weapons training, and people's anxiety level crashes through the floor. I have an athlete who is a 50 plus year old woman who suffered some severe physical trauma in a relationship with a broken neck. And wow, she's come to like 5 seminars now. She comes all over the world, and she tried to quit because of anxiety in the first 30 seconds of her first seminar. Absolutely not. You will stay here. I just need you to repeat this sentence to me. Do the work. I think she's been to 5 or 6 seminars now. Entirely different person. Different than she's been her entire life, according to her. Because now she's changed the way her brain works.
Yeah.
Physically, she's different. Mentally, she's different. There should be no way out. Nobody should fail training. A lot of training is designed for people to fail. Not our training. Our training is specifically designed to have 99% success rate, even if people don't believe in their own success. We will make it so. Dragging a line from Star Trek there. We will make it so.
Hell yeah. No, that's awesome. I think that's why your stuff is next level. You know, I got into this because I want to help people and I want to learn how I can do this the best possible way. And, you know, I think about this myself, like, not that I'm somebody that suffers from anxiety and depression chronically, but there are moments of anxiety and depression that exist in my life. And, you know, what do I do about that? So much of it is, I mean, you can't think your way out of anxiety or depression. It starts with that physical aspect. And after that, then you can start to train the, like you said, emotional, mental aspect. And then you get to points where you start asking about the things that are bigger than human existence, like what's beyond our human existence, which, you know, at some point it gets too much for people. But when you keep training and developing yourself and asking more questions, like you get to that deeper level. So let's transition to the spiritual part of this. Like, how has that like manifested for you? What are your thoughts about something beyond this dimension, beyond this life? Like, do you think about that a lot? And what are your thoughts about what is beyond this realm?
Well, I think about it every day because everybody should be thinking about what is the next steps in our existence. Some people, I have a lot of friends who are atheists, and I do not like that. I'm constantly battling with atheists at 2 a.m. somewhere in Hollywood. People who are saying that things are meaningless, and I don't believe that that is true. I think it's dangerous myself, but I think everything is meaningful. I think when people start to think about atheism, the problem that we have a lot that's going on in the world now is if atheism becomes the rule, then there is no afterlife. There is no eternal reward and or punishment. There is no next stepping on the wheel of Dharma, right? That then only what happens to you and your experience right now matters. And that, I think that that's probably why we're seeing a lot of negative effects in society right now, is because people are no longer planting a tree that they will never sit under the shade of. They're becoming fundamentally more selfish because they don't believe that society should continue or that civilization is good. And I think that that's insanely dangerous.
Or does it matter? Because that
doesn't matter.
That's the fundamental core thing. Exactly.
That's terrifying. Everything matters. Everything should matter. How you interact with everybody should matter. I believe that every interaction you have with people should be fundamentally positive. We all have our bad days where we're kind of dicks in traffic, but we should try to help people as much as possible, whether we see a benefit from it or not. I specifically think of my YouTube channel as something that can help people that I will never, ever meet. Everything I know, I put up. I don't hold anything back. We chuck out as much stuff as we possibly can, and we try to do it 5 days a week because we would like to make the world a better place in some way. If you can help any number of people, I think that that is good. I think that you should consider there to be a higher power and that you should consider there to be something after this life, because I think that that makes us all think about how we interact with people on a daily basis.
Yeah, and how important it is, you know, because your YouTube channel will impact people even after you're gone.
Yeah, the whole point is I would like to make a bunch of stuff that will help people for years. If I got hit by a car tomorrow, there's still enough programs out and there's still like 5 programs to be edited. People could still be getting benefit from it for years and years and years to come. That's what we want. We want to affect civilization positively. We don't want to have a negative effect on civilization. We should be builders, not destroyers. We should not be tearing down. We should be looking for ways to make things go up and be better. So we should do everything we can actively in order to try to make the world a better place.
Yeah, 1,000%. I really feel like no matter what color or where you're from or whatever you think defines you, I feel like all our consciousness are cut from the same fabric and we're all connected. And I feel like just from that feel right there, like everything that we do, say, our intentions in this world matter. And I think it's also ironic that we use the word matter to describe the physical realm, right?
Like, I think that that is an interesting thing as well. And I've been thinking about that for years. The English language is really interesting because there's a lot of things that cross over. And I don't know enough about linguistics to know if that pops up over and over and over again in other languages.
But it's interesting.
That idea of matter and matter actually, to me, really parallels the idea in Buddhism of Dharma. So if you look back through the different types of Buddhism and the evolution of Buddhist thought, and the 700s, you'll see there are a lot of schools of thought where they're considering Dharma. And a chair is a chair because it has chair Dharma. So is chair matter relate to physical matter? So this idea pops up. I know it pops up in physics and in Buddhist thought over and over and over again. And you can read books. I think Michio Kaku has a good one, where he talks about the breakdown between physics and Buddhism. There's a bunch of books on this topic. You should go read them all.
Yeah. Well, what's the Michio Kaku book?
Physics. I don't remember its name. I read it in 2002.
I'll have to do it.
College when I was doing like high level physics. And I was currently taking, I took every religion class I could find in college. So we read every major Buddhist text, every single one, discussed them in great detail. The Analects of Confucius, the concept of wu wei or effortless action, which is what we now call flow, is something that I've been talking about and reading about my entire life. So I think it's funny that physics and all of these things all interrelate over and over and over again throughout history. Nobody really knows the word wu wei, and it's shocking to me. Wu wei comes from ancient Chinese, I think, Confucius text and parts of Buddhist text that pops up over and over again. But wu wei means effortless action. And that is what we call the modern flow state.
Yeah, so right.
It's this word has been being used for thousands of years. And before the Red Revolution in China, that was part of a way that you actually got a job as a government official. You had to pass a series of exams based on the Analects of Confucius, if I'm right, for several thousand years. And it's only after the Red Revolution and they threw out that whole thing that things started to get, you know, more interesting. But wu wei is effortless action. It's modern flow state. A Japanese word that I hear pop up is wa, and it means your calm central state. So something can disrupt your wa. That means somebody's agitating the shit out of you. So you're trying to rebalance your wa, and you'll hear these ideas. I've read so many of these ideas, and I'm not sure anymore how many, if they're crossing over in my brain or not, but these are the words that I know to describe these things.
Yeah, no, but it's good. It's interesting because it's the same thing I think about, like keeping your nervous system calm under pressure. It's like what we battle for. I mean, it's what we try to do every single day, stay calm in the midst of chaos. And that allows us to be the best version of ourselves. Hopefully we could learn to self-actualize when we put ourselves under the right amount of resistance and the right amount of rest. And if we can do this over and over again throughout our life, we'll live a long, healthy, productive, beneficial life that adds value to humanity long-term, I think.
I agree with you.
Also, I also think it's interesting that, you know, you have programs out there on numbers and math, and you're a biomechanical engineer by education and trade. I mean, now you're a trainer, but I also think it's interesting that you have a place called the Art Asylum. So like one side of the brain is numbers, math, programs, and then the other one is this like philosophical, creative, artistic side. And I really think that's interesting and also like important to keep people healthy and balanced, left brain, right brain. You know, there's the physical part of things where we're going left hand, right hand, inside, outside, right? And then there's this creative force in us where we could express ourselves with a bunch of different movements, or we could write the best story or articulate something. And I just wanted to point that out. I think it's a super interesting thing because you're a numerical genius and you're also, you know, you have this artistic level to you.
I'd like to point out that I'm not a numerical genius. I'm a barely passable engineer when it comes to math. And I'm a terrible artist, but I like the ideas associated with these things.
Well, you know, you're an expression of both levels. I mean, has that always been a thing with you, or is that something that you've learned over time, or like how did you get this way? I just think like when we're talking about balance, when we talk about being in a balanced state, not just physical, but mentally and emotionally, hormonally, I think we need to have both hemispheres balanced. And that means being aware of how much numbers, spreadsheets, style of stuff is in your day-to-day and how much the other part of the coin, which is like self-expression and creativity part that you are putting out throughout the day. And I think having that is making you a balanced human. And I think more people need to figure that shit out. Like, is there one way that they're ramped up too much and not getting enough of the other? So like, tell me about like your specific process and how you got to be like that.
I grew up on a farm in the middle of nowhere. It was an equestrian therapy horse farm. So we worked with people who were handicapped either mentally and or physically. So that set the stage for you should help people, right? That and the work with the church when I was young, that set the stage for that. And I always did very well in school and study because I didn't live in town. You had to read books every day. There were two TV stations back then, right? And like two radio stations. So you didn't have a lot of other distractions. So I ended up getting pretty good at these ideas. I read Jurassic Park. I wanted to do science. I got into USC to study biochemical engineers because I wanted to make dinosaurs or, you know, Godzilla or something. So that part of your brain has to go work. But then once you get into LA, you meet a lot of creative people and they start explaining to you the value of being creative. You realize that it's already there inside of a martial arts practice where something like idiosyncratic movement in Aikido or Jiu-Jitsu, but you're like, oh, can we take it further? I saw a performance by this guy back in, I think, maybe 2004 at the brewery in downtown LA. And there was an art space there, the one next to Abshug, I can't remember what it's called now. And there was an LA contemporary dance company. And so it was a dance show, but during the interludes between, they had this guy come out and all he did was walk around the stage. And it was like, holy shit, this guy has turned walking from one corner of the stage to the next for 5 minutes, the most captivating piece of art that I have seen in this whole dance show. And talking to him afterwards, and he's like, yes, everything can be art and everything probably should be art at some time. And I was like, oh, well, we should turn everything into art. And then I got into the art scene here in Los Angeles, the circus scene and the, like, the fashion scene, runway shows, all that stuff for many, many years. And there was a big group of artists here in Los Angeles, and there are maybe 300 people in that community, and there was just art events all the time, all the time, all the time.
There you go.
Like 3 nights a week, but it could be art shows, fire performances, circus, and you just knew. And you, we all went everywhere kind of in these roving packs around the city, and there were places there where art was focused, and there were warehouses like this one, this is why it's here, where art could happen. And it was a specific place so that people could come and do some type of community-based art. It sounds kind of weird when you say it like that, but it was pretty awesome for years, because you would go someplace and know 20 people, and everybody was wearing awesome handmade clothes that they had designed for some specific reason. You could talk to them about it. I myself made my own clothes, my own pants and jackets for years as part of that. People aren't producing what I want. I should produce it myself so I can get what I want. And then we can talk about it. Things can be better. Like, oh, well, now you got to learn to sew. Now you got to learn something else. Now you got to learn about pattern sizing. Now you got to learn about how to do it better. What if we could make a 3D printed mannequin after we scan our own body? Who knows here how to scan a body? Can we cut it out of foam? How do we accomplish these tasks? So art and creativity should drive forward a bunch of things in your life, because you should never be done with that. That's the stuff that makes getting up worth it.
Yeah.
You do a bunch of work, you have a positive impact, and then it's fun to go to some type of art-based event where somebody is actively trying to make the world a better place by doing something. And it's different all the time. So one of the reasons we have Art Asylum is because the world became extraordinarily negative after COVID and during COVID. A lot of the art scene fell apart because you had two camps of people, and they, you know,
yep.
one yep. side really became difficult to deal with. So all the art spaces that I knew about in LA vanished because lockdown here in California lasted 2 years, which means if nobody can come into the space and nobody's allowed to work, all the art spaces vanished. So part of Art Asylum is trying to start to bring that stuff back. So
that's fucking awesome.
I want to have all my training shit. I want there to be a metal shop outside where people are making swords. I want people to be manufacturing cars. Put a flamethrower on top. I don't care. It's awesome. And then there should be circus performers in here. We had a ballerina in here last week filming a thing. So fire ballet, like a fire tutu performance, because it should be cool. If life isn't cool, what are we doing?
No, yeah, man,
it should be cool. And if it's not cool, it's probably your fault. I got into it. I was in Ohio and I went to this. I was in this small college town. I went into the bar and I was sitting there ordering a pizza. And there's all these college kids in there. And I said, oh, you guys are a college town. What kind of art facility do you have? And they were like, what do you mean? And I was like, you guys have an art program, right? And they're like, yeah, I'm in the art program. And I was like, so what are you doing? They're like, oh, this town is lame. We don't do anything. And I was like, you realize that's specifically your fault. You are an artist in training in a university town and there's nothing to do. That is specifically your fault. If there's nothing to do, go make something to do. You are officially in charge of making this a better place. That's literally your job. And if it's not, you just suck and you should get your shit together.
Mm. Well, I did definitely agree with that. Well said. And that was a wonderful story. But no, you're right, because like it is our fault. And if there's something we can do about it, why not? I always think that I learned this when I was a student teacher, and it's one of the best pieces of information ever. It's the only two things in life that you can control are your effort and your attitude. You know,
correct. So when you have that is a brilliant way to say that.
Yeah. Your effort and your attitude. And that it doesn't get any simpler than that. You know, it's like, how do you feel and think about this situation and what the fuck are you going to do about it? You know, and I think that's where people's legacies start. And I got to wrap this conversation up because I got an appointment here coming up. But I will say just picking your brain here for an hour has been awesome. And every time I interact, I get super inspired. So thank you so much, Mark Wildman.
When is your seminar in July? Because I want to try to get over to Chicago, because it's, part of being part of a community means that we should go to each other's stuff. So I want to come to your gym and finally see your gym.
I would love to have you. It's July 12th, 13th, and 14th. It's hosted by David Weck and Chris Chamberlain, Weck Method. They're doing first day is a rotational movement certification course. And then the next 2 days are the Weck Method qualification course. So it just breaks down more of the Weck Method philosophies and tools, the Bosu ball, the RMT club, the propulsors, ropes. And then there's definitely so much crossover with like some of the stuff that we do with heavy clubs, mace and kettlebells and all that. But yeah, that's the 12th, the 13th and 14th in July. Just let me know if you're interested, man. I'll have you at my house. No problem. You and Will, I would love to have you guys.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Danny.
Hey, thank you so much, Mark Wildman. We'll talk to you soon, okay? Thanks for your time. You're the fucking
man. Thank you, sir.
And that was the podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Make sure to follow Mark's YouTube channel and Instagram. Both are titled at Mark Wildman. He puts out videos almost every day, and there's something new to learn all the time. He also takes so much time revisiting several of the cues and the exercises that he's done in other videos. Super consistent, terminology is consistent, and it really does help you understand the fundamentals of unconventional training. So thank you so much for tuning in today. Make sure to follow my Instagram. It used to be at Danny Cola Fitness. Now we are at Underground Fitness Media. Thank you so much, everybody. Share this with somebody that you know will benefit from it. Please reach out if you have any questions. All love. Bye-bye.